could you introduce yourself, just your full name, and tell us what you do?
Well, my name is Alexander Sutter, and I'm a research assistant at Clifford Chance's white collar department at the Frankfurt office.
My name is Alexander Dunkelspüler, and I'm a research associate at Clifford Chance's international arbitration department in Frankfurt as well.
I did want to ask both of you to speak to, you know, now that you've been covering the trial for about 2 months since April, what have some of the most unexpected or dramatic moments of the trial been so far? But before we delve into that, maybe just for everybody listening in, can you tell us in a word what this trial is about? What are the crimes that are at issue? Who are the defendants in the trial? Where is it taking place? Just the basic facts.
Sure. What it is a war crimes trial held in Germany, which is unusual in some way because none of the defendants are German, none of the victims are German, and of course all the acts alleged did not happen in Germany. And this is possible due to a relatively recent addition to the German criminal code, which is called the Völkerstrafgesetzbuch, which means International Crimes Criminal Code, where the German legislators decided that war crimes and crimes against humanity should be prosecutable in Germany, even if there's no nexus to Germany as in any way, shape or form. And this is why in Koblenz there are now two people on trial who were members of the Syrian secret services, the intelligence services, and one of them was the head of the investigation sub-department at a place called Department 251, which is a interrogation detention center, a black site, in the middle of Damascus, actually, north of the old town. And the main defendant is accused of having committed crimes against humanity through a systematic attack on the civilian population involving torture, involving inhuman detainment, and also questioning people under torture. And he's this colonel in the secret services, and he was the head of the investigation department at investigation sub-department at Department 251, or the Al-Khatib facility, which is a name given to it for the neighborhood. And the second defendant was also a employee, we would say, in the broader sense of 251, but he was serving in a sub-department. He was a non-commissioned officer there. And it's interesting, the role of his unit doesn't become entirely clear because it is headed by a member of the McClough family, which are closely intertwined with the ruling Assad clan. So his unit is kind of a mixture of a demonstration suppression unit, an arrest unit, and also the personal bodyguard of Hafez McClough, the unit's commander. And he is accused of aiding and abetting crimes against humanity by arresting people and delivering them to the Department 251 facility to be interrogated under torture. And as there were a number of deaths at that facility as well, the main defendant is accused of killing people in the course of crimes against humanity, which carries life in prison. So there are very, very high stakes here.
And so you started following the trial in April, at the end of April, and so it's been a few months. Maybe Alex D., can you describe some of the more dramatic or more unexpected moments for the trial, of the trial? What have those been for you?
It's a good question. For me, a couple of moments actually stick out. Surely the one that was most memorable, or one of the most memorable, was when the defense counsel of Anwar Ruslan read out his statement. So Mr. Ruslan chose not to express himself during the trial so far, but he prepared a statement with his defense attorneys, and they read it out relatively early in the proceedings. And it was very interesting because it was very much awaited by everyone who was in there. Everyone was curious as to what defense he would choose. And personally, and I think that feeling was shared by many people, everyone was waiting for some kind of, quotation marks, Nuremberg defense, acknowledging the facts, but saying that essentially he had been following orders. But that was not what Mr. Ruslan chose to do. He essentially said he had no idea what was going on. He was just doing his job, pushing paper, essentially, and writing reports, but never interacting with prisoners or with never visiting the actual prisons, which were in the same building. And this went on for quite a while. And otherwise, what really sticks out for me is was the depositions of the people who had experienced Branch 251 and its torture chambers. And for instance, Mr. Anwar al-Bunni, the Syrian human rights lawyer, who spoke for 2 days and spoke with great eloquence about the plight of those who had vanished into the Syrian prison system, and those who had experienced torture and rape and horrible, horrible treatment. And that was such a harrowing experience, because you have to imagine that we sit on the public gallery, and around us are a couple of journalists, but also quite a few members of the Syrian community in Germany. And some of them don't understand German very well, but Mr. al-Bunni spoke in Arabic, so they were really able to participate and to listen. And you could see and feel the emotion around you when he was describing just the terrible fate and of those who had come, who had had the misfortune of landing there in this Branch 251. So that was really, really, really emotional and distressing. Especially the terrible situation of those who had suffered sexual abuse in this prison. Mr. al-Bunni memorably said that people who undergo this are punished twice, once through the act itself in prison, and then a second time by society, because the taboo and shame is such that they can never speak openly about it, that they have, some of them are rejected by their families. He spoke how he had to help certain women have hidden abortions afterwards. It was really, really tough to listen to, and it really showed the importance of prosecuting these crimes. Another moment, and I'm sure Alex S. will want to add to this, that stuck out for me, is the sort of vigils that the Syrians hold outside of the court. Every morning, when they arrive very early, some as early as 5:30 in the morning, and they bring with them dozens and dozens of portraits of people who are missing in the Syrian prison system. And they build up these portraits outside of the courthouse and place white roses on them and film themselves with it and talk to journalists and try to raise awareness essentially also of the people who pass by. And in a perhaps very German fashion, they're not allowed to do it on the site itself of the court, because you can't have political protests there, but they can't also do it on the sidewalk, because then the city would protest, because you can't put your stuff on the sidewalk. So they have to essentially straddle the fine line between the two properties. It's a bit absurd.
What really struck me, how the pictures or these portraits, they showed such a cross-section of society. There were people in business suits having obviously taken that photo for applications or for official web pages. There were teenagers in football jerseys. There were couples taking snapshots. There were kindergartners. There were, goofy groups of friends making faces into the camera. And it was really tough to imagine there's all these people, you know, from the kindergartner to the goofy teenager to the middle-aged businessman. They have all vanished for some reason or other and considered enemies by their own government for some reason or other. And it really shows that these crimes, they stop at no one. Like, everybody can get caught up and there's no escaping it.
Yeah, I'm just listening to you speak about how Anwar R. characterized his defense and then the testimony of Anwar al-Bunni. And I'm just wondering, I mean, the contrast between those both testimonies seems so, so great. I mean, how was it for you when you were in court hearing these very disparate views of the role of interrogators in al-Khatib branch? And what was it like for the rest of the audience in court?
It was they really did present a kind of split screen view of it. Both accounts are absolutely impossible to square. And I think for all, even if one might have been tempted to be convinced by the arguments of the prosecution, the fact that Mr. al-Bunni spoke so eloquently and in such great detail about his experience with not only the branch 251 Al-Khatib prison, but in general about the meaning of detention and torture for the Syrian state, really completely gave you a wholly different picture of what actually must have been happened in this branch 251 prison. And Mr. al-Bunni explained things that are not news, but that were news to this trial, about how much the Syrian government depends on the torture and the threat of torture and the threat of forced disappearance to sustain its power and to intimidate the opposition, to intimidate families of anyone who would dare speak up. And also it was particularly emotional for everybody else on the gallery who was for the first time really able to follow this story in Arabic. And so that really changed the tone of the whole story and the feeling of the room, because I was sitting between Syrians who were taking notes and who were welling up. And it was really an intensely emotional and very hard to listen to. I know that we will have more and more victims of torture who will come and take the stand and participate in the hearings.
Indeed, but I do know that a lot of the Syrians that I work with are following this closely. And they, you know, they're very resourceful when it comes to finding information that they need. I wanted to ask how this trial has impacted your understanding of the Syrian conflict and how your understanding has evolved in the time that you've been observing the trial.
For me, I realized how much the Islamic State had drawn attention away from the Assad regime for many years. Since it first began, the attention of the global media and of politics had been basically entirely focused on the crimes committed by the Islamic State. And these crimes were, in fact, egregious. There is no questioning that. But maybe that has shielded the Assad regime from criticism to some extent. They were only discussed in terms of military campaigns and of territory gained or lost. But what has really come back to the forefront through this trial, for me personally at least, is just the absurd brutality and cruelty that is the Assad regime and that is the Syrian state. And just how widespread torture and abduction and just senseless violence is, even in the parts of Syria that are not under the Islamic State, and even in Syria prior to the civil war. So for me, that kind of has recalibrated a little bit my picture of the conflict in Syria away from Daesh and back to Damascus to some extent. Because that is things that you can read about them, you can hear about them, but it's completely different, of course, to sit there when victims of torture and people like Anwar al-Bunni are testifying themselves. That is just much more personal and hits you in a completely different way. So that is one of the things that I personally have taken away from this about Syria in general.
Something that struck me was we have to keep in mind the trial provides a snapshot of this conflict, because which started in 2011 and then it goes up to when the defendants deserted, because obviously these are the times that are at issue in the trial. But what I thought that the great tragedy was how this regime doesn't have any, like, they don't have the instruments to react to requests for change, to demonstrations, to civil disobedience, right? We are getting, you know, reports or what is discussed in the trial is a period in 2011 when there was no civil war yet, where people were demonstrating, protesting in the streets peacefully, singing and dancing, and where your first reaction would be, as, I don't know, a sane government to say, well, these are people interested in civil society. These are the people who we should engage with and maybe, I don't know, enact reforms or listen to them. But it's a situation, you know, when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. They have no mode of responding other than barbaric violence. And so this is what they use. There's one episode, it was, you know, described twice, where Hafez Makhlouf happens on a demonstration, gets into a shouting match with the demonstrators, a peaceful demonstration, and then goes back to his modified Mercedes-Benz off-road vehicle, retrieves a machine gun and empties the clip on the demonstrators, and then exhorts the people around him, the soldiers, to do so as well. I think what really strikes me, we have this view how, you know, the Syrian regime and the Assad clan, they are these Bond villains who have this great master plan to, you know, suppress the people and so on and so forth. And what really comes out is in the face of, you know, civil disobedience and requests for change, they are as barbaric as they are incompetent. They only react with violence. They have nothing else there. And yeah, as I said, the tragedy is the snapshot we are provided with in the trial was of a, if you consider the Syrian conflict as a whole, as a more hopeful time. I mean, you have to consider Anwar, he deserted because he thought the Assad regime would collapse and he didn't want to be caught on the losing side as a member of the intelligence services of that fight. And so this is what comes through when people talk about, you know, these days in 2011. We, of course, know that the regime didn't collapse, that the war dragged on, that, you know, many, you know, the witnesses, they always mention the home cities, and their home cities are all cities we know were, you know, reduced to rubble. We know that from the news. And from the perspective, the timeline of the trial, that's all in the future, of course. And so what I took away from it maybe is that, you know, we look at it through our present lens and go, well, you know, all devolved into civil war, and there are these warring factions, all of which, none of which really deserve our support. There are Islamists, and there's the regime, and there are, I don't know, rebels backed by all kinds of government. But this was not inevitable, right? In the beginning, there was a very peaceful civil campaign for social change, for civil society, which was repressed as an you know, danger to the state. And it really brings that back, that there could have been other ways, but they were not, you know, pursued.